Lee Eisenberg's account of his search for the meaning of life, the point is, making sense of birth, death, and everything in between, provides a probe into how our life stories come to be and what it takes to find meaning and satisfaction. In his New York Times bestseller, The Number, Eisenberg chronicled our complicated relationship with money and why many confuse net worth with self-worth. In The Point Is, he goes one step further, giving readers the tools to infuse their personal and professional lives with meaning and purpose. Lee Eisenberg is a best-selling author. He is a former editor-in-chief of Esquire and has been a visiting scholar at the University of Pennsylvania. Again, the name of the new book is The Point Is, and we welcome Lee Eisenberg back to the roundtable this morning. Lee, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you, Joe.
What brought you to the subject and ultimately the point you wanted to make in the book?
First of all, it's a rather small subject, isn't it? Making sense of birth, death, and everything in between.
Right.
Rather audacious. What brought me to it, I think, is what brings all of us to thinking about, you know, why are we here? What's the point? Does it make any sense? What happens after we're here? And so on. And I think, you know, a lot of us think about that a lot. Some of us think about that a little. Some of us, you know, go crazy thinking about it. I think the genesis actually really lies in a book I wrote several years ago, having nothing to do explicitly with The Point. It was a book I wrote about money and why we're so uncomfortable with money. It was called The Number. And it wasn't an investment book. It was a book that tried to explain what is it about money that makes us so anxious, and why don't we plan better financially, and so on and so forth. And having talked to scores of regular people and a whole bunch of financial advisors, it became clear to me that we chase money, we chase this thing called the number. How much do we need? How much is necessary? But we almost never take time to think seriously about what that money is good for. And I kind of left it at that. And I didn't then go into, all right, so what is money good for? What is life good for? And that I felt I really wanted to close the circle on that, however immense a circle that sounds like. So several years ago, I started asking people, going around and again asking kind of regular people of all ages, you know, what's the point? Do you think about that? If so, when do you think about it? And so on. And that, in turn, set me off on a a journey along several parallel paths that produced the book that just came out very, very recently.
How important do you think it is for us to have a clear handle on the answer to that question of why are we here?
I think it's profoundly important. Obviously, we can get through life without asking that question, but my strong suspicion, having now thought about it a great deal, is if we don't have a grasp of why we're here, then I think we're really leaving ourselves open to a life that isn't necessarily unhappy, but I think a life that is fairly rootless, if you will, bored, listless. I think we can easily lose ourselves, distract ourselves, particularly today with, you know, all the devices we have at our disposal. But I think something continues to bother us. And a great many of us, particularly as we move through life, you know, I think when you're in, you know, first of all, we ask the question, why am I here, a lot when we're adolescents. It's not that you have to be old to do that. But as we move particularly into middle age, and then as we move beyond middle age, I think this question of, you know, what was that all about and was it worth it and did I make the most of it become, you know, really important questions. We may not talk about it a lot, perhaps we should, but I do think we walk around with that thought bubble hanging over our heads, which is, you know, why? And God knows this is not a new phenomenon. I think Adam and Eve asked themselves why the minute they, you know, took the bite out of the apple. So, you know, I'm not suggesting that you need to be a philosopher remotely to either answer the question or certainly, I hope, to enjoy the book. But I do think it's helpful to listen to other people grapple with the question. And then there's just a ton of interesting research in every imaginable direction that nibbles away at this question. The theory of happiness, you know, which you read so much about these days, There's all kinds of neurological studies being done about, you know, what does the brain do when it's feeling satisfied? So there's a lot out there to look at. But what I wanted to do was kind of take a journey, I think a personable and entertaining journey, through these questions and come up with, if not an answer for everyone, then I think a way to think about what the point is that could in turn open up some ideas in an individual's mind about, you know, what are they doing here in the first place.
You encourage readers to certainly become more active compilers of their stories, of their memories. How
memory, the more there are basically three, you know, paths that I went down with this book. One was just to try to read as widely as possible what great minds and writers have said about life's purposefulness. And you could do that, obviously. You can devote 10 lifetimes to doing that. The other thing that I did was, as I mentioned earlier, I asked a lot of people, do you ever think about this? When do you think about it? And, you know, are there some ideas that you've had that might be useful to other people? And then the third thing I did, and it actually then really became the main thrust of the book, is I started to think a lot and read a lot about the life story that you, Joe, and me, and every human being on Earth, quote-unquote, writes in their head. You know, we all write a life story for ourselves. It's the only way we can make sense of ourselves, of the world, of everything. And it starts really in earnest when we're about 3 years old. We start writing that life story inside. And the reason we do, or how we do, is really kind of remarkable, because two things happen almost simultaneously, which suggests that they're connected. The first thing that we do is we start collecting memories. Now, obviously, when we're three, we don't collect that many memories that endure, but we start collecting them, and then we collect them at a much greater pace in huge, rich abundance through the rest of our life. The second thing that we do is what we do with those memories. We develop the capacity for narrative. We beginning at age three, we learn how to understand stories, or we're able to begin to understand what a story is. And then the second thing is we know how to make stories on our own. You know, again, you know, every time I talk about stories, I'm not talking necessarily about writing stories, but understanding stories. And the reason we then, over the course of our lifetime, take these memories and build a life story out of them is we want to basically understand the narrative arc, if you will, that began when we were kids and, you know, end when the story is over. And it became really fascinating to me to think about the relationship that we have when we, quote-unquote, write these life stories in our heads to what real writers do when they actually sit down and, you know, write a novel or a short story or whatever it is. Many of the same principles apply, and it dawned on me one day, and please don't subject this to neurological scrutiny, that we all have, each of us, tiny little writer in our heads, you know, if you will. I call him or her the scribbler. It's almost as if we've got this writer up there, sort of nestled between the folds of our brain, sitting there with a, you know, this teeny tiny laptop and sort of leaning back on this ergonomically correct chair, and who knows, smoking cigarettes, you know, drinking vodka. I don't, you know, what do writers do? Whose job it is to basically pick among the you know, millions and billions of memories that we collect over the course of a lifetime and put those memories into a story. And then those memories get arranged in chapters. And if I were to ask you, Joe, right now, you know, what was the most exciting chapter of your life, you could tell me, presuming that you had one. You can tell me the worst chapter of your life. If I were to say, you know, what were the really important turning points in your story, you could tell me without you know, batting an eye. We each know our story like we know the back of our hands. What we may not know, however, is what were really the meaningful moments, what was really the meaningful experience, the meaningful relationship, the meaningful memories, and are we making sure that we are picking the right ones for the story, or are we taking certain ones for granted, or did we misinterpret an event or a relationship or an experience or a sensation or whatever it might be at the time? And does it pay us to maybe go back and re-examine how that little writer in your head wrote the story. And it may well be that the story is a whole lot more meaningful than perhaps you may have realized at the time, if you can subject it to a review now and then. And so this idea of how we create ourselves, how we explain ourselves to ourselves, is really the main thrust of the book.
So let me ask you one of the questions that I kept on asking myself as I was reading the book, and that is introspective versus retrospective, or introspective and retrospective. So when you have that rewrite and you have that review, as you just mentioned, how important is it for us to be introspective at the moment, to understand what is happening versus writing that story and understanding after we've had some time to digest?
Well, they're obviously both important, and you would have to be superhuman and far wiser than probably any human being who's ever lived to be able to understand or perceive the importance or meaningfulness or whatever of things that happen to you in real time. There are all kinds of studies that psychologists have done that show over and over again that we are constantly missing the point, if you will. That when we go back, as you say, retrospectively and think about something, we often see it in an entirely different light. I mean, it's just, you know, on the face, that's what we do. Or if our circumstances change later on, it makes that distant event or the memory of that event mean something else. So it's very hard to walk around and, you know, say, oh, my God, that's meaningful, and I'm going to immediately put it into my story forever, and I can't delete it. We don't do that, but one of the things I realized was kind of an epiphany when I was two-thirds of the way through, that once and only once in my life did I keep a diary. Do you keep a diary or a journal?
Yeah.
Have you? Yeah. I have not done that, but I did do it once over a period of about 2 years, and I did it around the time my two kids were born. So it's fairly easy to say, okay, obviously this is an important time in my life. I don't want to forget about it. Right. I want to remember it. I actually forgot that I even kept that diary. That was 25 years ago. But I was sitting in a library one day, and I said, oh, my God, that diary, I wonder if I still have it. And I went back home, and I opened up my computer, and sure enough, there's this document that had been squirreled away in a file on my hard drive, and the hard drive had traveled from desktop to laptop to survive 8 new Macintosh operating systems. It survived Steve Jobs himself, but it was still sitting there, and I opened it up, and I read it. It was a Word document, and I read it, and all of these thoughts that I had within that 23-month window, many of really the most interesting and revelatory thoughts came back to me, or observations that I had at the time. Our daughter was born in London because I was over there working, and I totally forgotten the name and the midwife who delivered our daughter, and how extraordinary. Here is this character who entered our life for a period of a couple of hours, who was very kind and was extraordinarily good at being a midwife. I had recorded her name, and I was able to remember her. And I think that's an example of how we have these characters that come through our life that then leave our life, but they share with us extraordinarily important, meaningful, in this case, you know, 2 hours worth. And some thoughts I had on a business trip about our son, who was one at the time, and everything else. So when I was able to go back and reread this, or read it really for the first time, I had a much deeper understanding of what it meant to me to become a father at the time. And, you know, obviously as our kids get older and they become teenagers and then they become millennials, we just as soon not think about them. But it really reminded me of the magic and I guess the mystery of becoming a father at the age that I did. So it alerted me to the fact that diaries or journals, which many of us are too busy to maintain, or what we say we don't write well, as if that matters, keeping a record of these events or sensations as they occur, you don't have to do it religiously, I think it really goes to the heart of your question, which is it more important to do it at the time or is it more important to do it, you know, retroactively? The point is, I don't think you really need to decide. The point is to stop. Well, I keep saying the point. The idea, the goal, is to make sure that things that are meaningful don't get left on the cutting room floor.
The name of the book is The Point Is, Making Sense of Birth, Death, and Everything in Between. The book is published by 12. Lee Eisenberg, a pleasure to have you back on the program. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Joe.
Take Great care. Pleasure. Bye-bye. Thank you. Again, The Point Is by Lee Eisenberg is published by 12. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.